Hi, my name is Ona Granuela. Welcome to the Brain Bag Podcast. We have Bonnie Glaser joining us today. She is the managing director of the German Marshall Fund's Indo-Pacific program. She is also widely regarded as one of the top experts on Taiwan in the United States. And this episode is going to cover basically all about Taiwan, sort of give you a primer about Taiwan and why it's been such a flashpoint in U.S.-China relations and why there's so much potential for conflict over it. But Bonnie, thanks for joining me here today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Andre.
So, Bonnie, what in general do we need to know about Taiwan's history, the PRC's history, the People's Republic of China's history, I mean, and US engagement in those histories to make sense of what's happening right now?
Okay, I'll have to give you, of course, a short version because the history is long. I will just share with you at least the highlights that I think are important. As far as Taiwan's history goes, in the early 17th century, beginning in 1624, the Dutch, the Spanish had colonies in Taiwan at various periods between 1624 and 1668. And in China, the last dynasty, which was the Qing dynasty, exerted limited control over Taiwan, really from the late 17th century until 1895. And I should also flag that the Qing dynasty was not Han Chinese. It was the this is when China was ruled by the Manchus. So that's, of course, another complicating factor. Was China controlling Taiwan at that point, or was it the Manchus, this dynasty that was controlling Taiwan? But in 1895, Taiwan became a colony of the Japanese Empire, and it was a colony for 50 years. And that ended in 1945. But the period from 1945 to 1949 is really hotly disputed. At that point, some people say it was part of the Republic of China, and others don't accept that. It depends on which of the treaties that ended World War II that you think are pertinent, and whether you believe that Taiwan's status was decided at the end of the war or not. But I think everybody can agree on one thing, and that is that Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China or controlled by the PRC, which of course was established in 1949. So the U.S. role is really, I think, particularly pertinent in a couple of different ways. President Truman was prepared to let the PRC take control of Taiwan, and that was after the communists won in the Civil War, and the Republic of China under the Chiang Kai-shek and his forces retreated to Taiwan. But that changed with the onset of the Korean War. After the war broke out, President Eisenhower sent U.S. naval ships to the Taiwan Strait and decided that the United States had an interest in defending Taiwan. And of course, the United States then signed a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan, and that was in 1954. Just if we jump forward, just to wrap up this history, in 1979, in January, the United States established diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And as part of that agreement, it abrogated that mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. And since then, the U.S. relationship with Taiwan has been guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, which was passed then in and has been in effect since 1979.
A good job summarizing a long history, so thank you for that. But so just so I understand it correctly, so in 1949, at the end of that civil war, the communists take over, the People's Republic of China is established. Chiang Kai-shek, who led the Republic of China, they go to Taiwan. So are we supposed to sort of understand Taiwan as being a Republic of China government in exile, or is that sort of an incorrect way of looking at it right now?
I think that it's fair to say that for many years after Chiang Kai-shek withdrew his forces to Taiwan, he did establish a government in exile. At that point, the KMT or the Kuomintang planned to retake the mainland. They really considered Taiwan a temporary home. It was a place where they were going to regroup and eventually go back to the mainland and take control of it. But that really changed over time. And in 1991, President Lee Teng-hui unofficially claimed that the government in Taiwan would no longer challenge the rule of the Communist Party in mainland China, although the Republic of China government under KMT rule actively maintained that it was the sole legitimate government of China. And to this day, of course, under the Republic of China Constitution, mainland China is a part of the Republic of China.
Interesting. So how does the Taiwanese government currently view itself? And how does the People's Republic of China view Taiwan right now?
Well, there's certainly an official position that the People's Republic of China has, and that position is that Taiwan is part of China. And the phrase that they use is they describe this as their one China principle. And that there's only one sovereign state under the name China, that the PRC serves as the sole legitimate government of that China, and Taiwan is an inalienable part of China. And all Chinese leaders have stated the position that Taiwan will eventually and inevitably return to Chinese control. This is not new under Xi Jinping. Every Chinese leader has said Taiwan is an inalienable part of China. So the position, of course, of Taiwan has evolved to saying that Taiwan is, or the Republic of China, is an independent sovereign state. That was first said, I believe, by Lee Teng-hui, and he was elected president in 1996, the first president of Taiwan to be elected through a direct election. And every president since then has said that the Republic of China is an independent sovereign state. And of course, the newly or recently elected William Lai, or Lai Ching-te, also has that stance.
So we have the PRC's official position, you know, dedicated to reunification with Taiwan and so on. But I mean, what's the practical position? I mean, while China claims Taiwan as that province officially, has that practical stance on Taiwan changed over the decades?
Well, if you're talking about practical in terms of does it exert any control over Taiwan, of course, then the answer is no, because Taiwan has its own laws, conducts its own elections. All of their top leaders are elected. They have a legislature, and they, of course, elect their representatives. Taiwan has its own currency. But that doesn't change the PRC's claim that Taiwan is part of China and will eventually return to Chinese control. So in terms of their expression of their claim over Taiwan, the one China principle reigns supreme.
So why hasn't China taken Taiwan since 1949? I mean, I know you mentioned earlier the defense pact that the U.S. has, President Eisenhower sending some of those naval vessels towards Taiwan and so on. But like, what's really stopped China from taking Taiwan? Is it the United States, or is it sort of something else?
Well, I think first and foremost, China has lacked the military capability to take Taiwan. And this has been a mission of the People's Liberation Army going all the way back to 1949. But I don't think that the Chinese military really started to get serious until after the Taiwan Straits crisis in 95, 96. At that time, you know, President Lee Teng-hui was in the United States. He was an alumnus of Cornell University, and he went back and gave a speech, and the Chinese really viewed him as being provocative and challenging Beijing's sovereignty claim over Taiwan. And China decided to punish Taiwan by lobbing some missiles around Taiwan. And at that time, that was the only military capability that China really had. It could send missiles to Taiwan, which were not highly accurate at that time. And in fact, there's been some reports that one of those missiles actually flew over a very small part of Taiwan, which really alarmed the United States at the time. But there was certainly no capability to invade. And so the PLA had to begin after that to actually develop a force that could take Taiwan. And the first thing that they decided to deal with, even before they thought about having the capability to land forces and establish a lodgment on Taiwan, they realized that they had to prepare for the possibility of US intervention and have their own capability to impose costs on an invading US force. And so the Chinese began to develop what we have called anti-access area denial capabilities, or A2AD. And those capabilities, their missiles, their aircraft, there's other capabilities that they have that would inflict a great deal of pain and high costs on US Navy ships or aircraft that might intervene to protect Taiwan. So the United States has had to itself respond to how to think about how to limit the negative impact and yet be able to defend Taiwan if the US president chose to do so. So over time, we've seen the PLA developed various kinds of capabilities. And first, it was the A2AD capabilities. China now has the largest inventory of land-based ballistic missiles in the world. Of course, it also has cruise missiles, it has hypersonics. And then China is now developing a larger nuclear force. For some time, they only had about somewhere around 200 nuclear weapons, and now we think they have about 500. And according to the Pentagon's report, China is likely to have 1,500 nuclear weapons by 2035. So that's been part of the development of their capabilities. And then thirdly, they have been focusing on their amphibious landing capability because you got to get boots on the ground if you're actually going to be able to exert control over Taiwan. So I really think that the main reason has been that China hasn't used force is that it's really lacked the capability to do so. A second reason, of course, is that every Chinese leader has understood that using force against Taiwan would carry a high cost. I don't think a Chinese leader is likely to use force unless they believe that they can, first of all, succeed in that effort, and secondly, do so in a way that would be tolerable for the People's Republic of China. So I think that's really what the main reasons are.
You mentioned, right, that there would be a high cost, and that has led to, a lot of leaders not wanting to do that. But has Xi Jinping's approach to Taiwan, approach to that question of reunification, has it differed from his predecessors? Is he more likely to use force, for example? Because I feel like that's the big question in everyone's mind, certainly the question on DoD's mind, the US Defense Department's mind, whether there would actually be an invasion. So, like, has Xi really differed from his predecessors, or is it more of the same, except a bit more explicit?
Xi Jinping has said many things about PRC intentions toward Taiwan. I would say a lot of them is continuity with prior leaders. He has said a few things that I think are notable as being new. One is that he has said twice that differences between Taiwan and mainland China should not be put off from generation to generation. So, in other words, should not be postponed indefinitely. And that perhaps suggests a little bit more impatience. Some people think that it suggests urgency. I'm not convinced myself that reunification with Taiwan is a legacy issue for Xi Jinping, something that must be achieved during his time in office. That's debatable. There are a lot of people who believe it is a legacy issue. I think Xi Jinping is always thinking about what that cost-benefit calculus is. And if the costs are too high, then he would not actually use force, even if it is the end of his rule. And we should also note that we don't know how long Xi Jinping will actually remain in power. He could stay, you know, until he dies, or he could decide at the end of another term, his third term, which is what he's in now, or his fourth term, that he is going to groom a successor and pass on the baton to someone else. The second thing that he has said, which I think is interesting, is that the 19 Party Congress, that was in 2017, Xi Jinping said that reunification is essential for national rejuvenation. And the achievement of national rejuvenation is not new. Every Chinese leader has said that this is a goal that the People's Republic of China has that must be achieved. It's returning China to its greatness. And so Xi Jinping, what he has done that's new is to attach a target date to that. He has said that this is something China must achieve by 2049. Now, we should note that I believe, according can calculate quickly, I think Xi Jinping would be 96 years old in 2049. So based on actuarial tables, I don't think he's going to be with us, but I don't want to wish him ill. So maybe he will still be ruler of China, but odds are he won't be. And so is he actually, by saying that unification is essential for national rejuvenation, maybe he's even suggesting that this will be something that he's going to pass on to the next leader. But at a minimum, I think Xi Jinping wants to have the trajectory of the cross-strait relationship in the direction of the two sides coming closer together. And right now, I would say that they are still moving farther apart.
Mm-hmm. No, and in terms of moving farther apart, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about potential conflict over Taiwan, between China and Taiwan, sort of that historic conflict. And I think a lot of folks in the general public will often hear about Taiwan in that context of like, oh, goodness, will there be a war in the near future? Will the U.S. be pulled in? But I think what a lot of people, at least in the general public, don't necessarily understand is that there are like a lot of economic ties between Taiwan and China. So I'd love for you to sort of talk a bit too, you know, what some of those economic and even political ties are between China and Taiwan.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Taiwan and China have very close economic relations, that it's an interdependent economic relationship. Taiwan's ICT products serve the world, and they certainly serve China. There are many semiconductor chips that are produced, or electronic parts in Taiwan, components that go into something that the PRC then makes and exports abroad. Taiwan companies, beginning really in sort of the early 1990s, started to invest in mainland China. And so there are over 1 million Taiwanese that live in Taiwan, businesses that have invested in China. Some people in Taiwan have their houses and families on one side of the strait and spent 6 months then on the other side of the strait. So they really live in both places. So there's a lot of course, trade. Taiwan's exports, a very large percentage of Taiwan's exports go to mainland China. And many of those, again, are components. They're not final products. But the peak, I believe, was in 2020 when Taiwan exported 44% of its exports to mainland China and Hong Kong. The period of COVID and the implementation of U.S. restrictions on technology and these advanced semiconductors to China have led to a reduction in that percentage of exports. And I believe last year it was 35% of Taiwan's exports that went to mainland China and Hong Kong. So less than it was, but still a fairly significant and not only significant amount, but China is Taiwan's sort of, number one export market.
No, and speaking further on Taiwan's economy, I mean, you mentioned that interdependence between China and Taiwan, but Taiwan's economy, it feels super important. We hear about TSMC, we hear about semiconductors, we hear about the linkages with the tech market. Could you expand on, what Taiwan's economy is like and how it sort of fits into that global picture, therefore probably raising, further geopolitical and economic risks if there is a conflict?
Well, there's no doubt that Taiwan's economy is very integrated into the world and that global supply chains in some areas depend on Taiwan. If we look at just advanced semiconductors, 92% of the world's most advanced semiconductors come from Taiwan. Taiwan semiconductor manufacturing, TSMC, is the world's leading company. Up until about 5, 6 years ago, TSMC only had its fabs, its production plants in Taiwan. Now TSMC is establishing some of those fabs outside Taiwan in the United States, in Japan, and in Germany, but it's still a very small percentage of the chips that they actually make. But it's really interesting that there have been some efforts to estimate what the impact would be on the world if there were to be a conflict or even a blockade by the People's Republic of China and Taiwan without a shot fired. So there was a really pathbreaking report that was published a couple of years ago by the Rhodium Group in New York. And they did some number crunching and developed a methodology and essentially posited that if there were a blockade around Taiwan, but no kinetic use of force, that the impact of that on the global economy would be more than $2 trillion in annualized. And so, of course, the greatest impact would be on Taiwan, and then the second greatest impact would be on mainland China. But the real main message of that study was that the entire world would be impacted if there were a just not even a conflict, but just if trade stopped because there was a blockade imposed in Taiwan. And that's been a wake-up call for countries around the world that even though Taiwan may seem very far away, say, for example, from Europe, nonetheless, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the economic impact on Europe seemed to be enormous, but it was a drop in the bucket compared to what that impact would be if China were to blockade Taiwan.
Which is scary. It is very scary. So I mean, the United States maintains quote unquote unofficial relations with Taiwan following the US recognition of the People's Republic of China in 1979, sort of abiding to that one China policy where the PRC is the one China. And we also have this idea of strategic ambiguity, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's this idea that the US, we're not sure if the US will come to Taiwan's defense or not in case of invasion. But I mean, Bonnie, what does unofficial relations mean? I mean, what is the US relationship with Taiwan, and how does China view that relationship?
I don't know if any U.S. official could even give you a very clear definition of what unofficial relations mean. When the United States established diplomatic ties with the PRC, we were essentially saying the PRC is the only representative of China in the international community. And so we have diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China, but we're still going to have cultural, economic, and in fact, other kinds of relations with Taiwan. And if you read the Taiwan Relations Act, which is short, it is sort of worth reading. Congress helped to create a framework for how the United States would interact with Taiwan in the aftermath of breaking relations. And so we created this structure of having the American Institute in Taiwan, which has an office in Washington and an office in Taipei. And so our State Department does not conduct relations directly with Taiwan. We do it through AIT. And so the structure enables the unofficial relationship. But a lot of what we do with Taiwan mirrors very closely what the United States does with countries all over the world. Now, I think Beijing opposes virtually everything the United States does with Taiwan. So we know that. But of course, it opposes some things more vehemently than others. And we often read that China has said that it opposes, let's say, weapon sales, for example, to Taiwan. So that's true, but probably everything that the U.S. does with Taiwan, U.S. officials get demarched at some level. And on the question of strategic ambiguity, you know, the way I like to explain this is that in 1954 to 1979, as I said, we had a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan, and the United States did have an obligation to defend Taiwan, to consult with Congress, and that we would consult with Taiwan, and we would come to its defense if it were under threat. But that's when, in 1979, we abrogated that treaty. We just left it ambiguous as to whether or not the United States would defend Taiwan. If you listen to the words of President Biden, he has said four times he would defend Taiwan if it were attacked. He is the president elected by the people of the United States, so he has the right to say that. But when he adds, that's the commitment we made, he's actually not saying something that's consistent with U.S. policy or with the Taiwan Relations Act, because we didn't make a commitment after 1979. But no U.S. official would say, oh, our policy is one of strategic ambiguity. It's not the way the United States characterizes its policy toward cross-strait relations. It's the way experts outside of government explain or characterize whether or not the United States would come to Taiwan's defense. But I think there's a really important caveat here that everybody does need to understand. We don't have a government in the PRC that doubts that the United States would defend Taiwan. So people who advocate that the United States adopt strategic clarity, in other words, say, we will give Taiwan an ironclad commitment to its defense. No matter what happens, we will defend them. Some people say that we should do that because we have to make sure that the PRC doesn't miscalculate, that they know that we will be there and that that will strengthen deterrence. But the reason why that's not terribly persuasive is because we know that the PRC, and importantly, the PLA, assumes that the United States will intervene to defend Taiwan. They have to. All militaries have to plan on the worst case scenario. And that is the worst case scenario. And in fact, they know that it is the most likely scenario, even if it isn't 100% certain. So although the people of Taiwan, I think, would like to have an ironclad commitment to their defense, I think many people, certainly in the Biden administration that I've talked to, separate from the president, haven't talked to President Biden, but people say it isn't necessary in order to strengthen deterrence. What we really need to do is to have the military capability to defend Taiwan, because it would be a bad place for the United States to be in if we say, oh, we'll defend Taiwan no matter what, but we then don't have the capability to do so. So I think military capability is essential, and that's one of the things we need to focus on.
No, definitely. So, I mean, so now my question may be a dumb question, but I mean, like, you know, my working class parents, they'll be watching the evening news, they'll be seeing all about, you know, these high tensions. And they may have the question about, like, okay, like, why is the U.S. trying to defend Taiwan if they want to do that. You know, like, why would we get pulled into a war, you know, right? So, like, and we mentioned earlier, right, like, Taiwan's economy is super well integrated into the global economy. There are huge questions about supply chains, but why is Taiwan so important to the United States, you know, beyond that economic question, to, you know, to the notion that we would go and defend Taiwan potentially?
Well, people definitely have different answers to that question. There are some people who would just highlight, for example, our dependence on Taiwan for semiconductors. I wouldn't start there. I personally would probably end there. But I think Taiwan is important as a democracy. It's a model of how ethnic Chinese people can govern themselves and do it very, very well in a democratic way. So I think standing up for democracy is important. But no, we don't stand up for democracies all around the world. So maybe that in and of itself is not enough. I believe that if China used force against Taiwan and succeeded, it would be more likely to use force elsewhere. To solve its outstanding territorial disputes, which we know they have with Japan, with India, and of course, with many countries in Southeast Asia who have claims to some of the land features in the South China Sea. So I think we need to demonstrate that we will not stand back and allow China to use force in order to advance its interest. We would all pay a very high price for that. And then I think the United States, of course, does have ironclad commitments to allies in the region and beyond the region. So, of course, Japan, South Korea, Australia, and those in Europe, the Philippines and Thailand are also U.S. treaty allies. And if we did not come to Taiwan's defense, we would not be seen as a reliable partner. My guess is that the consequences of that would be things like Japan deciding to develop nuclear weapons, which I think many countries believe would not be a welcome addition to peace and stability in the region. And then countries would no longer see the United States as a leader. It would probably affect our status within the NATO alliance, our relations with Europeans. So I think Americans think about our relationship with Taiwan as almost it's a litmus test that if China invades Taiwan and we don't come to Taiwan's defense, it's the end of the U.S. Role as a leader in the world. So I think it would be catastrophic for America's reputation.
No, and you know, one of the hottest topics right now is continuing U.S. aid to Ukraine, and you know, because there's been a lot of controversy about the potential cutting of aid and what that means for the war in Ukraine. Is the Chinese government watching this? Is the Taiwanese government watching this? Are people sort of using that perhaps as an indicator of how the U.S. will come to aid Taiwan in case China invades? And you know, if there is no U.S. aid, would Taiwan even be able to defend itself? You know, I think that's another big question that I'm sort of overshooting.
Well, the latter part of your question about whether Taiwan can defend itself, I would say, is a work in progress. Taiwan is focusing more resources. It is engaging in more realistic training. Conscription has been extended from 4 months to 1 year. But I think that Taiwan didn't take its defense seriously for a long time. And now that the threat is much more realistic, and because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which has really brought home, I think, to people in Taiwan that it is really possible that China actually could invade. And of course, encouragement from the United States to take their defense more seriously, that is making a difference. Over time, I think it will make a substantial difference. And of course, you can read through the lines there and conclude rightfully that I don't believe that China is going to invade Taiwan in the next few years. But I think we really do have to do what we can to strengthen deterrence. And part of that is Taiwan demonstrating that it has the resolve and the capability to defend itself. And even if it can defend itself, the question is then for how long? Because if the United States does not intervene, then I think it would only be a matter of time. Let's be honest here, that China's military capability is many, you know, multifold times what Taiwan's military capability is. But I think most people think about this as a question of, oh, can Taiwan hold out long enough for the United States to flow a significant amount of forces to help? And I don't know what that length of time is, but it's several weeks and probably several months. And so Taiwan has to work on that. And your question about Ukraine, again, is important because there have been senior officials in Taiwan who have connected very closely Taiwan's future with Ukraine. They fear that if Russia is allowed to take over Ukraine, that that will not bode well for Taiwan's security in the future, that China will draw lessons and think that the United States will give up defending Taiwan, just as they fear now it will not no longer provide resources, weapons to Ukraine. And so they do connect their own defense, many people on Taiwan, with that of Ukraine, and really are sending messages on a daily basis to the U.S. Congress to continue to support Ukraine so that the message is sent to authoritarian governments like Russia, like China, that they cannot succeed and that democracies will stand up for their interests.
So I want to round out this interview now by asking you about your thoughts on the most recent Taiwanese presidential election. We saw William Lai get elected very recently. He'll be taking office, I think, in a few months. But was his election significant in any way? Would that election sort of guarantee more tensions between China and Taiwan? What does his election mean for Taiwan and, you know, the potential for further conflict?
Well, the first point I'd like to make is that since Taiwan started to have direct presidential elections in 1996, they have never had the same party remain in power for more than two terms. And one term, like in the United States, is 4 years. So the one party has been in power at most for 8 years. And then the electorate has voted for the opposition. And there have only been two main parties in Taiwan up until recently. There have been smaller parties, but they have been inconsequential at the national level. And so the KMT has been in power for no more than 8 years, and the DPP had been in power for no more than 8 years up until now. And so this is a third term. It's a new president because the president is term limited, but the DPP will remain in power for at least one term, 4 years, maybe for two terms, which would be then another 8 years. So it's pretty significant that this is the first time a political party in Taiwan has won a third term. The second thing that I think is significant is that the winner, who is the president-elect, who is William Lai, he was challenged by two people, and one, again, from the KMT, that the candidate was Hoyo-i, and the other party was, as a relatively new party in Taiwan, the Taiwan People's Party, that is led by Ko Wen-je. And so they ended up, those two opposition parties won together 60% of the vote. And William Lai won with a plurality, but only 40%. So 60% of the voters in Taiwan did not vote for him. So he doesn't have a strong mandate. And that's very unlike the current president. President Tsai Ing-wen won with about 56, 57% in the last two elections. So she had a very strong majority and a strong political mandate. And then the last point about this election is that the DPP lost its majority in their legislature as well. So nobody has a majority now in the legislature. And the KMT will be trying to work together with this Taiwan People's Party to oppose the DPP on some things. But I don't think that they will forge a a solid coalition, because I think that Ko Win-jeon, the Taiwan People's Party, wants to try to build leverage and have influence, and at times, depending on the issue, will probably support DPP legislation, and other times will support KMT legislation. And then in your question as to whether the election of Lai guarantees more tensions, I would say not necessarily. So far, William Lai has said that he will build on the cross-strait policies of Tsai Ing-wen. He, in his acceptance speech, said that he would adhere to the ROC constitutional order. This is a phrase that Tsai Ing-wen invented, but essentially means the constitution, but the amendments that have been added to it as well matter, not just the original constitution. And then there's the Act governing relations across the Taiwan Strait. I don't know whether he will explicitly say that, but Tsai herself did when she was inaugurated in 2016. So he has committed to continuity, but I think over time, he will become his own person. He's not going to be a carbon copy of Tsai. He, of course, has been a politician for many years. He was mayor of Tainan. He served in the legislature and in the National Assembly in Taiwan. He will have his own ideas. And he's a long-standing member of the DPP, whereas Tsai Ing-wen joined late. And so, yes, she's part of the DPP now and was when she was elected. But he has been a member of the DPP for many, many decades. So I think we'll have to wait and see how his own positions evolve over time. But it would be wrong to say that tensions will necessarily increase. But it's fair to say that Beijing is already included. It is fair to say that Beijing has already concluded that Lai is a what they call dangerous, diehard pro-independence element. So they don't trust him. And they will not have any kind of official communications or exchanges with Taiwan, which, of course, they haven't had since Tsai Ing-wen was inaugurated in May of 2016. So it looks like, in terms of the cross-strait relationship, things won't get better. And the only question then is, will they get worse? And we've already seen Beijing take at least two actions since the election. One was to poach one of Taiwan's diplomatic partners. So Taiwan had 13 what they call their diplomatic allies, and Nauru, a small island in the Pacific, switched its diplomatic recognition to Beijing under great encouragement and inducement from China. And then there's this flight path that goes near Taiwan, which was established years ago by China. They call it M503, and Beijing just decided to move that closer to Taiwan. And it's just they have all these different tools that they use to gradually squeeze Taiwan, their international space, their security. And the goal is to convince the people of Taiwan that they're lives would be better off if they joined China, and to demonstrate to the people of Taiwan that the U.S. can't help them, can't protect their security, and isn't really a reliable partner. That's the message that China's trying to send in its propaganda and its disinformation to Taiwan on a daily basis. And I think that China has not given up on this strategy. It's a strategy of winning without fighting, of relying more on pressure and coercion to achieve their goal of reunification rather than using force.
Well, Bonnie, on that note, thank you so much for joining me here today. This was a great primer on, you know, why we need to care about Taiwan in the context of U.S.-China competition, in the context of potential conflict around that area. And, you know, you are one of the leading experts, if not the leading expert on this topic. So thank you so much for joining me here today. I greatly appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. And I hope your audience will be more interested in Taiwan. There are some other good experts out there and things to read. And if I can plug my book. I co-authored a book with Ryan Hass of the Brookings Institution and Richard Bush, who also is still affiliated with the Brookings Institution, about U.S.-Taiwan relations. And so it's 130 pages. It's very digestible. It has a short history and a good discussion about policy options that and scenarios of the for the future of the U.S.-China-Taiwan relationship. So, for those who are interested in finding out more, I'd suggest our book.
And folks, we'll have a link to that book in our description so you can buy that, read it, digest it, and really start to understand beyond this Zoom room more about this big issue. But thank you, Bonnie, once again.
Thank you, Andre.